Welcome to The Art of the Impossible, a podcast for the design and manufacturing industry that explores how you can leverage technology, processes, and people to make the impossible possible. I'm Asif Mogul, Senior Industry Manager at Autodesk, and each week I'll be joined by two experts from the design and manufacturing world to discuss their perspectives on the challenges our industry faces and share what they're doing to overcome them. From smart products, mass customization, digitization, supply chain resilience, and the convergence of once diverse industries, this podcast is for anyone that runs a design and manufacturing business who's interested in making things possible. You can subscribe by following us on Apple, Spotify, or via your favorite platform. Hi, everybody. Welcome to this episode of The Art of the Impossible. Today, we're going to talk about how we can make change part of the everyday. Now, over the last few years, we've had to deal with really rapid and unpredictable changes in our lives, in our workplace. Transformations that would have previously taken months or even years have had to be done in weeks and months themselves. And companies have had to react to unforeseeable circumstances with like levels of flexibility that were unheard of. And so we've seen that responding with that level of agility and flexibility at that speed is actually possible. But often we've only responded as an industry out of some kind of a necessity. And I suppose you could say we've previously had to cope with agile change in the design and manufacturing industry. So the question is, could we shift our thinking to turn this level of agility into an asset? How could we make that level of change a natural part of everyday lives? We'll be discussing how continuous and agile change can reduce risks and improve efficiencies in our industries, and the impact that technology might have on that change, but also the cultural foundations that underpin effective change in any organization. So to have that discussion, I'd like to welcome my very special guests for today, Karim Sakat, who's the CEO of Oxford Engineering Group, and Dr. Sally Eaves, CEO of Aspirational Futures and a Global Strategy Advisor. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And likewise, real pleasure. Looking forward to our conversation today.
Fantastic. Okay, so let's start off with just allowing the audience to get to know you a bit. Karim, could you just tell us a little bit about Oxford Engineering Group and the sort of things that you do?
Oxford Engineering Group is a total manufacturing solutions provider. We make very large to very small machine parts in all sorts of materials, which are then welded, assembled, and tested to our customer specifications. The traceability and controls of all production operations must be strictly adhered to. We are a global tier one supplier to Siemens Healthineers and Varian Medical Systems in the medical field, preferred category A supplier to nuclear customers, both in medical and strategic defense markets. Other areas include instrumentation, aerospace, and oil and gas. We have spent many millions in hardware investments, but also in software and people to allow us to become truly agile. I should mention that our scheduling system researched has discounted the one used by NASA. We invested in another ultimate software solution that we have been further developing for months now. We now work with real-time data on the shop floor. Another example would be our latest laser CMM, only the second one in the country after world champions Red Bull Formula One team acquired the first one. This to give us the best and fastest possible quality reports. But we are also preparing the future. Having won a national competition, we have launched our artificial intelligence program with Manchester University and Innovate UK. In other words, we're in constant flux.
Yeah, absolutely. Sounds like you're certainly no stranger to change. So thank you and welcome. And Sally, if we could ask you to tell us a little bit more about Aspirational Futures and your role as a global strategy advisor.
Absolutely, with pleasure. Thank you. So yeah, I kind of work right across technology, culture, and education. So Aspirational Futures is a non-for-profit. We do a lot of work around STEAM learning, using tech and data as a force for good, themes around sustainability, the green economy, for example, and working with a lot of people from underrepresented groups. So a real passion area of mine, advancing that around the world. And in terms of global strategy advisory, I'm a CTO and CIO by background. So I did a lot of work right across the technology estate, you know, from AI to 5G to IoT and security, working with a lot of the big leading enterprises of our time, but also bleeding edge startups as well, which I absolutely love doing, working around how you can use the latest technology, how you can integrate, also how you can pragmatically reuse older technology as well, and also embedding that in a focus on culture, process, and skills. I'm also a podcast host and an author, and my book on Tech for Good comes out later on in the year. So really excited about that. Again, raising money for good causes.
Fantastic. Oh, okay. Well, it's nice to have a fellow podcast host on a podcast. I'm not sure if that's a weird experience for you or not, but welcome. Okay, so let's kick off. Sally, perhaps we could just stay with you. I think one of the first things would be good to start with is let's try and define what we really mean by agility. So if you think of agility in the context of design and manufacturing, how do you define it? What is agility?
Yeah, absolutely. I also think sometimes we focus it only on one level. So I think enterprise agility, for example, has been one of the terms that's used particularly over the last 6 to 12 months. I think we need to move beyond that. So I look at agility in three different levels. So yes, from an organizational point of view, but equally from that team and individual perspective as well. So it's that capacity to be able to react quickly and be responsive to change and kind of get ahead of it. I think, you know, particularly over the last 2 years or so in COVID times, there's been an acceleration of digital transformation. I think a lot of organizations right now are in a period of reflection. You know, what's gone really well during that time? What have we learned? What can we do better? What do we want to do differently? But agility is absolutely that flexibility, that ambidexterity to change. And it's not just, for example, access to skills and technology to make that happen. It's also empowering people with the confidence to apply those skills as well. Something I think sometimes gets left behind in the conversation. So definitely ambidexterity, flexibility, getting ahead of change before it comes to you, so to speak. But making sure that's right across a technology, you know, culture, education, process, conversation, is the integration and visibility of all those different areas that really makes that happen.
I really love how you sort of split agility into the organizational team agility and individual agility. And I think that's kind of a really useful framework for somebody to maybe get their head around, because I know when we talk to manufacturing leaders, sometimes they think of agility as just maybe the process. You know, I need to get from my design to manufacturing faster or manufacturing tech. But I think if you look at it in a more of a structured model that you've just laid out, that I think that might be a bit more of a useful way for us to implement agility into an organization. So I really love that definition. Karim, so we've just heard a great definition of agility, but you know, in the role of your organization, the CEO of an engineering company, it might sound like a strange question, but why is agility so important to our industry?
I don't want to be controversial, but it might not be for everybody. We need to understand, what is agility? We hear a lot about the Internet of Things, the need to move to being agile, to being able to move. Why do we need to be agile? Is it because the product change all the time? Is it because we just want to follow the herd? We need to understand for ourselves, our own businesses, what is the need of that business. For us, we have a great need to be agile because we have very competitive pricing. We need to change our supply chains. We need to change how we do things. And globally in manufacturing, we have 30% of waste, and that waste needs to be eliminated. But then we say, okay, to me, it doesn't mean anything to be agile because it's not defined, it's not data driven. So when I ask my team to understand agility, I say, what does it mean? And therefore, we need to have KPIs around it. So KPIs around agility would mean, for example, that we can service a customer by responding to a quote in 3 days instead of 10 days, by being able to produce something in 1 week instead of 2 weeks, by being able to move from one machine to another without any hindrance. So it needs to be defined. So we have defined and mapped all our processes from the beginning of the communication with the customer up to the delivery to see where we were not agile and whether we should be agile or not. For example, Our quality department does not want to be agile. We are very stringent about how we do things. And if it takes time, it will require the time. Now, we have worked a lot, for example, in buying a new laser CMM. Before, we could do a check of 1 point per second. Now, with the laser scanning ability that we have, we can do 600,000 points per second. So that process has been sped up, but all the activities within that process will not be sped up. So that, for example, when we work in the nuclear field, all our customers can be satisfied that every step has been taken. So when we talk about agility, we need to understand the reason why we need to be agile. And it needs to be correlated to either a drop of cost or a drop of time, not agile to be agile. That doesn't bring anything. So if someone, for example, in manufacturing is manufacturing only a million of the same pieces, there's no need for them to be agile. For them is to have a repeatable process, or to do that process quicker, and that's it. There's no need for agility. For us, we work with many different customers that have different products where they need to intervene at different points in the production process and then restart thereafter. And then it changes. The whole schedule is a schedule that changes on a daily basis. And therefore, we need to be very agile so as not to delay the whole program.
I think that's a really interesting answer. It kind of reminds me of some of the comments people used to make about Industry 4 and maybe make now about digital transformation. Sometimes there's a pressure. There's almost like a need or a pressure. Companies feel like, I need to do this. I need to get Industry 4. I need to be digital transformation. I need X, Y, and Z. And what you're talking about seems to resonate with many of the other conversations we've had on previous podcasts is it could be important for your business, but you need to understand that it might not be important for your business. But what you're talking about is if your business has mapped out its entire life cycle, and you understand the KPIs, you understand the metrics, and you have that key understanding of where in the process speed might be useful, agility might be useful, flexibility might be useful. It sounds like that's probably a great exercise to start with before you can answer the question whether agility is important to your business. And it might be important to a part of your process or all of your process or none of your process. That's a very interesting response. I think that really resonates well with a lot of other comments we've had.
I think it's interesting as well. So just reflecting on that about where kind of the drivers for agility are coming from and where they're changing as well. So, for example, around all things ESG, there's a rise there from, you know, increasingly conscious consumers or ecosystem partners to deliver more on those particular areas. So I think it's an interesting time at the moment where some of those vectors have evolved and accelerated too. So that was the other thing I was thinking about when Kareem was speaking there about where that desire or need or imperative even to innovate is coming from and the changes we're seeing around that in the ecosystem at the moment.
I think that's a brilliant topic, Sally. So maybe we could dig into that. So from the work you do, and you talked about a huge sort of cross-section of people in industry from, you know, globals, multinationals to like SME startups. What are some of the most common drivers that are creating the need for agility that you see?
Yeah, I mean, they're coming from different areas. We've got geopolitical factors has created a lot of things, particularly around supply chain and things at the moment. Definitely all factors ESG. I think really, you know, for more and more organizations right now, it's almost a social license to operate in many ways. Definitely the resonance around that, you know, something that was maybe once a bit periphery is now, you know, much more need urgency to be transparent, but also accountable for measurement and delivery around ESG factors. Also things around security as well. I don't think we've ever seen a period of time where kind of the scope, scale, and sophistication of threats around cybersecurity has been so vast, and the speed of change around that, you know, things like bad actor collaboration has really risen recently, and things like IT and OT convergence as well. All those things in the round, you know, everywhere we look, there's a lot of change happening. And so again, areas around integration, visibility to support that, and making sure we've got that investment, not just around technology, but culture, skills, and process is absolutely key. And again, I think when it comes to the technology side of things, another thing I've noticed is there's been quite an increase in, for example, using multiple vendors, multiple tools, multiple techniques. That can be really useful, but it gets to kind of a tipping point at times where there can be too many of those, and it can actually create new risk and complexity and negate the benefits they can bring. So again, I'm seeing a lot of reflection around that, about the best way of managing things, and you know, have we made the right decisions? Let's reflect a little bit, and in some cases actually streamline.
I think that one of the key parts is to understand where the bottlenecks in the organization is, because you might be a lot more flexible or agile in a department where you don't need to, or you might get more agility in that department, but because it pushes the bottleneck down the line, you haven't effectively had a better service to your customer. So you have to really understand and follow through all the bottlenecks to decide where you need to be agile first and whether it's going to have an end impact or not. Because if you're only impacting part of your company, you've made a big investment for no return effectively. So you got to be very careful about following the bottleneck. So if you haven't mapped it all out and put a case and a scorecard on all of those things and know and understand what is your throughput, whether you are able to increase it or not, you will see that you need to be agile in different departments. And some of it is not technological. We all the time talk about technology. I'd like to share a small thing with you. COVID hit us, the first pandemic we've had. A lot of people buried their head in the sand. Nobody knew what to do. We locked ourselves in and we said, okay, what would happen if the government asked us to shut down for a year? Do we have enough cash? What happens if one employee gets it? Are we putting all our employees in jeopardy by asking them to come to work? And by doing that exercise that a lot of people took a very long period of time to do, we were at the forefront of developing a communication tool with our employees. So we color-coded that tool and everybody knew color blue, come at work as usual, color red, we're completely shut down, and there is you're moving from blue to green to amber and so forth as the risk increases, and everybody knows at which stage what we need to do. And that had nothing to do with technology. And we all had the same brain. We didn't invent anything. We looked on the internet, what is this government advising? What is the German government advising? What are these guys doing? And getting ahead of the curve by thinking, okay, what is our worst case scenario? You know, because we did not know what is going to happen, and we're all in the same situation. But our employees were very grateful because they're could see that we were trying to think to make it all secure. And we, one day, we had, at the beginning of the pandemic, one employee getting the COVID. And at that point, we shut the factory down. Everybody knew what to do. We had our drills in place. Nobody was scared. And actually, all the employees wanted to stay with us to clean the place. And we said, thank you very much. I think that that's great camaraderie. But really, we don't need you here. We need you to go home for now. Yeah. And we will see you. We will see you on Monday. And let us clean it with our processes. But all I'm saying is, when you break that fear down, when people understand it, when you communicate it properly, then a lot of resistance fall away and everybody embrace it.
That's a wonderful example, actually. It sounds like what you're doing at Oxford, you have done a lot of this sort of thinking when you've had time and space to think and mapping out these processes and KPIs and these contingency plans. So Sally, we just heard a really great example from Karim about how his organization has sort of almost spent and invested actually time to look at their processes, develop these KPIs. I think you used the term scorecards, map out some scenarios, maybe some foreseen challenges, some unforeseen challenges. I'm just wondering why it's so difficult for more organizations not to do the same thing. I mean, why do you think manufacturers struggle to talk and develop the sort of agility we've just heard Karim talk about?
Yeah, I think there's multiple factors in play. What I loved about Karim's example was that focus on co-creation and all voices being heard at all levels of the organisation. I think that's just essential to get that buy-in, to reduce that resistance to change. And again, it's that investment in culture and people, not just the technology and processes, for example. It's that mixture. So I love that. I think that's great. I think overall, definitely a lot of challenges at the moment I'm seeing around complexity. And when you drill into that, a lot of that is lack of visibility. So for example, you know, siloed data, multiple sources, not integrating that properly. Same thing around the tech estate, particularly when we've had so much, you know, acceleration over recent times. A lot of issues around legacy tech and not just being able to see in real time exactly what you've got and really making the most of that data. So kind of going from data volume to data value, if you will. One of the things, one of the missing components I probably see the most that kind of brings a lot of these elements together is focus on change management. You know, areas like continuous integration, continuous delivery and deployment, or CICD, it's really, really useful. It's that focus on incremental change, incremental innovation. It increases that, it reduces risk. And again, I think some people think it's the opposite. You know, if you do more small regular changes and iterate more, aren't you kind of increasing more risk into the estate? Actually, all the evidence shows it's the opposite. You know, it gives that gain of agility. I see that a lot. You know, teams have the ability to release changes to customers, observe that impact, and then iterate really, really fast. It gives you a bigger feedback loop as well. So I love that as an example of doing things better. But also, for example, being very pragmatic. There's a lot of data waste in organizations today. It's something like, I think 90% of data archived isn't touched again after 3 months. Yet we've also got a lot of skills challenges. You know, I'm working with organizations right now using that data as in a safe, open sharing way as a learning opportunity, particularly for reskilling people in non-technical roles. So again, I also think the mindset and the approach is really valuable here as well. And that's just an example of that.
If I could just rebound on this point, I think, and I might not do myself any favors here, but one of my first failures was to buy a very expensive piece of equipment that could be, in theory, fully automated. And it took us about 6 years to automate the first part on it. And that had to do with a lack of my own understanding, because when we were sold a machine, it can do everything. And theoretically it can, but we didn't take many things into consideration. For example, programming languages. For example, the number of tools that the machine would require to do several different paths depending on the pallet sizes, the tolerances that were required, the finishing that was required. When we move from a certain material like aluminium to another type of material, and what will go actually in the used oil and how it's going to be serviced out of the machine and so forth. And you don't realize that you have, when you start, an exponential number of variables that you haven't thought of. And all of those variables will stop you from being fully automated. And a lot of people will therefore say either the machine is rubbish or it's too complicated, it's too costly, we will never get there, and therefore let it go. Other people like me will say, okay, let's map this out. Let's map all of those variables and let's understand the interdependencies. I think that's very important between those variables to see that how we can lift it up without having a bottleneck somewhere.
You know, it's really interesting. In the world of coaching, I think there's a term called doing an ecology check. So people will say things like, I want to achieve X outcome. And it might sounds great on a sort of a soundbite and a piece of paper, but there's sometimes not enough thought given to what will your world be like when you do achieve that outcome. What will you gain? What will you lose? What are the challenges you haven't thought about? And what you're talking about here, Karim, is almost like it's a level of simulation. Not I'm not talking about simulation as you would like mechanical simulation or stress analysis, but there's almost like this business model simulation. It feels like perhaps that's one of the reasons why some manufacturers have a negative experience of making investments in certain bits of technology, hardware, software, whatever, because they're not really able to do that type of simulation, that kind of like forward thinking, forward planning, imagining their world when this technology is in place.
Well, I think that is key. When I started and we analyzed the business, we created a war room. And the whole room at the end was completely filled with all the variables that we had. And we needed to understand what we wanted to standardize. And we're talking about design strategy in terms of programming languages, ERP systems, how we manage our business intelligence tools, how we manage our material, how we transport our material, how we put descriptions into the CRM. I mean, there's so many different variables, and it's frightening. I mean, if you really do it and you're honest with yourself, it's frightening. And it takes years to say, okay, from now on, we're going to only buy certain machines, we're only going to use certain design tools so that we can integrate them and that we can make use of it. So at every step, you get a little bit more agile, but you need every department, every person to have an understanding. Because if you don't integrate the programming team with the quality team or the manufacturing team, then you have a bottleneck somewhere and all the work that you've done is for naught. And that is really depressing.
I've absolutely got to come and visit you, Karim, because I want to see this war room. But what you've talked about there is something that really, every single podcast episode we've recorded, this topic always comes up. And you talked about your people, getting the departments together, breaking down silos and barriers of communication and information. Now, that sounds easy, doesn't it? But it can be an absolute challenge for organizations. So, you know, so Sally, maybe I could come to you on that point that Karim made. My belief is that people are at the heart of every business. And as you said, it's all about change management. But how? If you're an SME, if you're not Karim's organization, like Oxford Engineering, let's say you're an SME that's just more traditional or struggling with broken processes, systems, resources, whatever it is you're struggling with, how would you then sort of say to your organization, do you know what? We've got to start bringing our people together and communicating. How do you hardwire that level of collaboration and openness into the DNA of your organization? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, it's a great question. I'll probably tackle that in a couple of ways. So just reflecting on what Karim was just saying and your point there about it all comes down to people. Absolutely. I mean, there's some research that I've been involved in directly, and I was the PI, which it sounds like a detective, doesn't it? But it was principal investigator. It took over 2 years. It was published in April. And that was looking at what the enablers and what are the barriers to digital transformation across multiple sector verticals. The top three across the board were people related. They came down to skills. And the really interesting thing around it was not just, for example, democratization of access to different skills. It was also around skills confidence and actually applying them in your role or in your future role. So everything was coming down. And as I say, these top three were people around skills and around culture and around vision. It was those types of aspects that came to the fore. So I would say with SMEs and SMBs in particular, focusing on that area first is absolutely key, and also override perceptions. There's a lot of SMEs or SMBs that I've worked with and feel that, for example, the right resources are going to be out of reach. You know, they're going to be non-accessible because there's a cost barrier, there's a time barrier, all sorts of different things. More and more, particularly on the skills piece, there's been a lot of progress over the last 2 years in terms of making more education and awareness facilities available to more and more people and organisations of any size. So firstly, I'd want to challenge that perception, because there is support out there, particularly on the skills uplift, for example. So that would be the first thing, absolutely, definitely. And then also focus on the types of skills that you're investing in too. Now, I'm a big advocate of STEAM, which is kind of STEM plus the arts in its broader sense. You know, help people be creative, have empathy, build relationships, that type of area, and problem solving skills alongside the technical components as well. That is really, really important as part of that cultural DNA that you were talking about there, and learning styles. You know, that matters as well. You know, we don't all learn in the same way. And quite often, you know, training programs in organizations can be one kind of format only, but we all learn differently. You know, there's this metacognition is kind of gym for your brain, as I like to call it, and it helps you identify that. So I advocate with organizations of any size, trying to be a little bit more personalized in training programs, because you get so much more from that as a result. So for me, those would be kind of a starting point, is definitely look at the culture and the skills factors of your organization and benchmark your progress along the way as well. I think kind of taking that pulse of change is really important, so you can track and measure, get people involved. Karim's example earlier was a great example of that, but that's important too. It helps to build that buy-in, and where things are, you know, not according to plan, you can intervene more early. So definitely benchmark where you are, and don't just be attracted to what the shiny new thing in tech is. It has to go back if it's a fit for your organization or not. You really need to look at that, because sometimes it won't be the right thing. But it's that time to evaluate and the right support in place to be able to do that effectively.
We call it the shiny ball syndrome. Sometimes
yes.
it's so easy to get distracted by the shiny ball syndrome, but you have to sort of keep your feet on the ground and say, actually, hang on a minute. Let's go back to my mapping. Let's go back to my objectives. Is this going to help me achieve the objectives I want? If it is, great. Let's look at it. If it's not, actually, what a nice shiny ball that is, but let's move on, kind of thing.
Exactly, so, exactly.
Sally, that's a really interesting point that you've made. And I'm going to go back to Kareem, because Kareem, you talked about this this process that you've been through. I'm guessing maybe it was easy and seamless, but what challenges did you face with your people? Did they kind of embrace this process with open arms, or were there fear or uncertainty or doubt? Could you just talk us through how that was and what some of the things you did to overcome that would have been?
So I will let you in into a little secret of how we evolved as a company. At the beginning, like every other company, we were also a company that is fearful of change because we knew how to do what we were doing. And at the beginning, there are certain ways and everybody is happy with those ways. I read the Toyota way, which is a different way to deal with manufacturing, which is based on a single piece flow and not on batch manufacturing. I was convinced of it, and I shared it with my management team, and none of them wanted to join in. So I went on vacation with my wife and kids. I brought with me 17 books on lean manufacturing and single piece flow. I read them all, sometimes during the day, sometimes after they were asleep. I went sneaked out to the bar to continue my reading. And it has really formed my view that what we were doing with one of our main customers was really something that would benefit from this approach. So I came back, I tried to share it with presentations and so forth to my management team, and nobody was on board. I started talking to the people who were manufacturing, they were not on board. I started talking to my customer, they were not on board. And all of them fearing a failure and what the impact of that failure would be. So I visited many companies and I was really convinced of it. So I started thinking, how can I convince my board and my management team that we need to do things differently? So I was passing by Toys R Us, I stopped there, bought a lot of Legos, and instead of having board meetings, I said, you know, put all the paper away, we're going to start building Lego cars. And on my left, you're going to do single piece flow, on my right, you're going to do batch manufacturing. And we would win on the single piece flow, and they would say, yeah, but that's not complicated, that's not what we do. So the next day, I'd be at Tesco's, and I would buy pens and papers and invent another game. We'd write letters and do the same kind of tricks, and single piece flow would win. But I was not able to reduce those defenses, because every time they would say to me, this is okay for Legos, this is okay for this, this is okay for that, but not for our environment. So at the end of the day, I had to make a decision. I've tried everything, I'm convinced of it, I've tried to change their mind, and nobody's on board with it. So yes, I had to put an ultimatum on the table and say, guys, this is what's happening. I've now invited someone on the board. I now invited two consultants. It is happening with or without you. So the train is leaving. Who's with me? And whoever's not with me, the door's open, no hard feelings. But it is happening, and it is happening today. And we forced it through. At the end of that, all our employees were far happier with the way they were working, because we solved an untold number of issues. And our customers came in and saw it and actually thought at one point that we were faking something, because I had put alarms in the boardroom, in my own office and so forth, so that when they have a problem on the line, they would push the alarm. And the idea is that we all see what the issue is and it is solved there and then, without a lot of different layers of communication, and then nobody remembers what is there. And as I was presenting to our biggest customers, and I had about 15 people in our boardroom, the alarm goes off. And I say to them, sorry, we have an issue with one of your products. Shall we go and see? And they thought we'd faked it, and we hadn't. And we went to the line and we saw the issue, and everybody was talking about it. And then we went back, and it was a prime example. And at the beginning, we had a lot of issues we were not even aware of, but they were caught in the system. So we would spend time and money, you know, reducing those issues or finding other ways. At the end of the day, this customer gave awards to all the suppliers worldwide. We picked up 2 out of 3 awards, one for excellence, one for innovation. So all I have to say, you need to do your homework. You need to be convinced. But as soon as they saw that that change actually brought everybody happier, so the customer was happier, they're getting faster deliveries. We were delivering within 24 hours. Our employees knew what they had to work on, so there was no more stress. They got also new equipment. We sorted all the issues, so no one shouting, I'm missing this, I'm missing that. And so everybody was happy at the end of the day. So when they saw that we broke the camel's back with that, we continued on that change. And they accepted that actually change can be for the good. People are fearful of change for the wrong reasons.
That's a really interesting answer, because sometimes we hear it's kind of a very, you know, just let's just spend time convincing people that it'll be okay, it'll be okay. But I guess there's a point in time where you just have to give a bit of tough love, but with compassionate tough love, let's just say that, like you were saying, the train is leaving the station. You're welcome to join it at any point, but we're going. And what I think you've done there is sort of demonstrate, you know, we talked about this sort of ecology check earlier on, what will the world look like? And what you seem to do then is demonstrate what the world actually will look like if you do some of these things. And I think your people were able to bring themselves to a point to say, oh, wow, actually there isn't anything to fear. And then their motivation comes up. So it's a really, really great story.
I mean, we went the extra mile to make sure that, you know, all the floors were painted. They got new equipment. They get dedicated equipment for them, you know, with their names and numbers and tags and all the rest of it. So it, at the end of the day, it was the best working environment out of all the companies that we had. So people started being jealous of that and say, well, I'd like to work in that environment. And so you create kind of a snowball to say, yes, you do have to invest. And we invested more than we needed, because we also wanted to make a point to say, guys, if you join us, you're going to benefit from it. You know, you're going to have a nicer working environment. You're going to have nicer hours. You're not going to be within problems all the time and so forth. But at the beginning, when we start saying, well, we want to have a stopwatch and check how long it takes to perform, they all got scared. They thought, oh, they want to get rid of us. And no, we actually got more work and we hired more employees and everybody was happier, from the customers to the suppliers and our company as well.
All right. So, Sally, at the beginning of the episode, you talked about the topic of ESG. And so it just kind of made me think, I'm just wondering if you have an example of how this kind of agile change or agility has had an impact on, you know, critical global issues like sustainability. Is there an example of an organization you've worked with that's responded in a positive way? And are there benefits that you could share?
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much to this question. So first of all, for me, things around sustainability, ESG more broadly, they're part of what I would describe as a shared value business model. I think that's where we're going. You know, we've got consumers that are more conscious, ecosystem partners expecting people to deliver on these types of metrics now as well. Same thing for investors as well. So everywhere you look, we've got this movement beyond not just talking about sustainability and doing the right thing, it's delivering on it. So it's going from, you know, transparency to commitment to accountability. And I've seen lots of examples about how that's been done well and some challenges along the way as well. So one very practical example, big enterprise I do a lot of work with, they distribute PCs, for example, and other aspects around technology right across the world. Huge organization, very complex and large supply chain. They partnered with a bleeding edge startup in India who were dealing with what on the surface looks like a really challenging problem around pollution in a city, for example, diesel exhaust. But rather than that becoming a really negative thing, it was changing the narrative. Let's make that pollution into something actually practical and usable. And that soot, for example, from diesel exhaust could be converted into paint that was used on the packaging for the computer components, etc. And that has now been rolled out right across the world. So turning something negative into something positive, and a great example of collaboration. Because again, I'd love to mention that. I think one of the great things that's come out of a really, you know, difficult, challenging period of time for everyone with the pandemic is it being far more focused on ecosystem collaboration and doing things better together. Those organizations traditionally competing, coming together around a shared day, but also examples like that with big enterprise coming together, you know, with a pioneering startup to make a difference. So that's one example. I think another one would be around visibility. I mean, we spoke about dashboards. Karim mentioned dashboards earlier on, which could be fantastic to, you know, really shine a light on the metrics that matter. I think sometimes when it comes to ESG, those metrics might be hidden, or they're treated differently, or they're siloed somewhere differently. I think cloud is a great example of that. You know, we had a big acceleration to cloud. There's a lot of dashboarding around there. You know, cloud waste is a big hot topic at the moment, up to 30% in certain cases. But actually, cloud can make a big difference around sustainability. You can identify when you can reduce consumption, for example. You know, you can be reflecting on, you know, can we rise up or rise down in terms of what we're doing with our technology at the moment. So I think that's an interesting area as well. Bringing all those metrics together, making them visible in one place, real time, at the right time, to the right role, and not separating these things out, that can make a difference. And again, it's a shared value benefit, more efficiency, better productivity, reduced energy consumption. So I think those are two practical examples.
Again, it's all coming back to collaboration, shared value.
Absolutely.
What's great about this conversation so far is we haven't really talked too much about productivity and hard metrics like profitability, X, Y, Z. It seems to be there's a layer underneath all of that that precedes all of that that we've got to get right. And if we get those things right, then some of the traditional business metrics that we're used to measuring should come as a result. So I'm loving the focus on collaboration.
Absolutely. And can I just mention as well something else that's coming out very shortly? So it's got a moniker called Rosie. Which is return on social impact evaluated, because what I've found is it can be quite hard for people to make comparisons. You know, a lot of organisations are bringing out CNE ESG reports, say, once a year. That's good for the organisation. It's great that you're making that transparency around what's happening. But I think, A, we need more regular benchmarking. So, A, as an organisation, you can see progress or areas to intervene earlier. But equally, a lot of these are internally facing measures. So it's hard for consumers to compare organisation B with A. Similarly for ecosystem partners when they're looking at who to work for, who to advocate for, etc. as well. So that's something that's bringing not just quantitative metrics but qualitative ones together. It's kind of zooming in on insights on processes, which I think sometimes gets left behind, plus also looking out at broader systems as well, but really focusing in on learning opportunities and that focus on doing too. So that's coming out in a couple of months time as well. So I'm hoping that would be a great step forward, and again, that's a result of collaboration, you know, different types of businesses, civil society, citizens and scientists, universities, local governments and councils, etc. So again, it's that coming together. Let's see what we can do by open, secure data sharing and learning from one another for that shared goal around sustainability and other ESG outcomes like DEI, for example, too.
Great. So we coming to the part of the podcast where our guests, we put you in charge of the global manufacturing and design industry. So you are now, whatever those titles are, joint CEOs of Global D&M Inc. And we've got every single leader of every single design and manufacturing company you could possibly imagine listening to what you're about to say. And what I'd wanted to ask you both, if there's a piece of advice, a really practical, actionable piece of advice that you would give to a leader who wants to become more agile or have this sort of, you know, be able to respond to change or turn agility into a really good asset, what would that bit of advice be? Karim, perhaps we could start with you.
A very simple piece of advice would be to read The Goal. It's a very easy read, but it teaches you about the fundamentals of manufacturing and the importance of bottleneck. And once you understand that, you can start your journey by understanding where your bottlenecks are, where you are not agile, where things are not structured in the right way. And you keep designing and writing it down and keep writing it down and create yourself your own wall or you do it on your OneNote or whatever tool you use, but you map it out. Just map your world out. Once you map it out, you understand whether you are part of the problem or part of the solution or what you need to do in order to make it better. A lot of the time you have good people, good machinery, and you don't have good communication and understanding of those processes. I think it's a journey that everybody can make. You don't need to be, to have a specific degree, or you just need to have the interest and understanding what you do and how you do it.
Great response. Thank you, Karim. So Sally, same question to you. What's the one piece of advice you would give every leader out there who's considering going on their journey to agility or becoming more agile?
Yeah, I love that. So I'm going to go for a different take, just reflecting on what Corinne was saying just now. And I'm going to say, reflect on the fact of how much expectations and behaviours have changed. You know, whether we're talking about employees in your organisation, consumers that buy from you, and your ecosystem partners as well. So I mentioned earlier about the importance of transparency. I think the other word and ethos that springs to mind, reflecting on a lot we've talked about today, is the importance of trust. You know, I would say it's the biggest currency of our time. So when you're talking about digital transformation in your organization and bringing people with you, trust is an imperative. Equally, when you're looking at people, again, externally and how they value you as an organization and the value of that relationship, that product and service, trust is right up there as the biggest differentiating factor, I would say, in certain the research that I'm involved in. So don't be afraid to talk about your journey and the progress on the way and when things haven't met the timeline you might have set. People will actually even trust you more. It will actually enhance that relationship rather than the opposite. Now, I'm working with an organization right now around ESG, and one of their fears was the fact that we're putting some information out, we're setting some quite ambitious targets, we're not sure we're going to get there, and then, you know, what's going to be the result of that, and people in the organization won't go with us anymore, and people externally will think, oh, they've missed this, they've missed that. And my advice to them was, actually look at this trust barometer research over the last 17 years. For the first time ever, big business is now the biggest bastion of trust for global perspectives than, for example, even NGOs and certainly government as well. But what people want to see is transparency about that journey, the steps taken along the way. And if you miss something, as long as you're really authentic and honest about that, people understand, because they understand there's a lot of challenges right now at the moment, and they're quite complicated and they're quite interrelated. But invest in trust and transparency, both internally and externally, and that will massively support your digital transformation journey, whatever set you're in.
Fantastic. Again, another wonderful piece of advice. So I'm going to try and summarize everything I've learned from this conversation with you both today. Let me just reflect back to you both what I think I've understood. So in terms of agility or flexibility, whatever we want to call it, change is happening all over the world. Some of the change we can foresee, some of the change we cannot see. But the rate of that change seems to be doing nothing other than accelerating. And I'm wondering whether what we're talking about is just being ready to anticipate and look at those things, making decisions on, do these things affect me or not, based on data, and maybe not doing something about it, but perhaps preparing a response and being ready about it, but then being ready to react quickly in an appropriate way. And in one of the appropriate ways might be, we don't need to do anything. But constantly being ready to change. And I get the sense that that's really what we're talking about when we sort of talk about agility and change in our industry. And what seems to be important to bring to the table when we think about these things are a clear understanding of the outcome you want to achieve as a business, a collaborative mindset where your people are at the center of it, and really making sure that you do invest in your people's skills, both their skills, knowledge and ability, but also their confidence. And in terms of the next steps that perhaps somebody should take, I love the fact that we're talking about map your world out, as Karim was saying, map out your world as it is today. Go into your, I think Karim called it a war room, but go into your sort of secret den or your bat cave or whatever we want to call it. Get those post-it notes up on the wall. Be fearless about doing that. I think that's what I picked up from you. And then picking up on that sort of fearless sort of conversation, Sally, you were talking about investing in trust and transparency about your journey, the warts and all. So I feel that that's kind of like what I've learned from you both, which I hope kind of, you know, resonates.
Seconded, absolutely.
All right. Well, you've both taught me very well on this call. So I'm hoping that you, as you're listening to this episode, there's something in that that you can think, I'm going to try this or try that. There's something about what I've heard, which I'm going to pick up the phone and speak to someone about tomorrow, or I'm going to just invest in time and doing it myself. As always, I hope there's a golden nugget in today's episode that you can take away. I want to thank my guests for being such engaging guests on and having a great discussion. So thank you, Karim Sakat, CEO of Oxford Engineering Group, and Dr. Sally Eaves, the CEO of Aspirational Futures. You've been fabulous guests. I hope you've enjoyed being on the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's been a great time sharing with you.
Absolutely. I loved it as well. Really great, meaningful conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And we'll see you again on the next episode.